tonight I'm speaking with a colleague of mine who was actually one of the first people I got into contact with during the beginnings of Project Unity, and he's been on the channel a few times. All of our previous talks, by the way, will be in the description box below. But it's been a while since we jumped on record together, and since then I've gained more subscribers. And so what I'd like to do first, before we jump into this discussion, is to give people listening who haven't heard of Mr. X before a little bit of background on how we got connected. Because early on, when I'd first made the platform Project Unity, I was fortunate enough to get into contact with a number of people, including Richard Dolan, and I managed to get connected to people like Richard, Grant Cameron, James Rigney, and a few others because I released a promo video, sort of like a trailer, for a project that I'm still working on, which involved the Admiral Wilson leaks.
It's out. The most significant leak of UFO-related documents in many years, perhaps of the century, is out.
So when I put this promo out, it caught the attention of people like James Rigney, Grant Cameron, Richard Dolan, because of their direct involvement with getting the Admiral Wilson documents out into the UFO community. And so I was put into direct communications with them, and it was on my first phone call with Richard Dolan that he mentioned a mutual friend of ours. Now, at the time, I wasn't sure who he was referring to, but this person turned out to be Mr. X. He had not got into contact with me at this stage, but he was following my channel and had obviously mentioned his interest in Project Unity to Richard, so it was from this point that I got Mr. X's email from Richard Dolan and we began communicating. Now, it didn't take me long to realize that this individual had an extremely in-depth knowledge of the UFO issue, the history of the secrecy, and some of the potential science behind the energy and propulsion systems. One area that Mr. X displayed immense knowledge in was the Admiral Wilson leaks, and this led to us putting together a 3-hour breakdown of the Admiral Wilson leaks, or Eric Davis notes. This 3-hour breakdown, a link for which can be found in the description box below, caught the attention of New York Times reporters Leslie Kane and Ralph Blumenthal. Now, they got into contact with Mr. X and myself within 24 hours of the breakdown going live on my channel, with the request for us to make the breakdown private for a short period of time. Now, the reason they asked this of us is because they were, at the time, and likely still are, researching the Admiral Wilson leaks. Some of the information that was included by Mr. X within our breakdown could be considered as actionable intelligence regarding people who are still alive today who could be questioned about their potential involvement in the scenario that is described in this leaked transcript, and the copy of this transcript, for those that don't know, the one that went public came from the estate of the late Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. Now, Mr. X has since been utilized by Leslie and Ralph due to his phenomenal research abilities. One thing that is extremely important to remember is this: no matter how mysterious the name Mr. X may sound, people need to realize that we both came up with that name off of the top of our heads, just because he didn't want to give his name out publicly. He's not an intelligence insider. He hasn't worked for the government in any capacity. He is simply an ordinary guy with an extraordinary research ability and an undeniable passion for the UFO issue and the mission of disclosure. For all those listening, there will be visuals throughout the interview to help provide context when needed, and I all hope you enjoyed this conversation on exotic physics and UFO secrecy with Mr. X.
I have been studying the Sapphire Project very intensely for a few years now, but to give a background on what they're doing, and I want to state that I am putting the pieces of this puzzle together, the greater puzzle together, and I'm not a representative of the Sapphire Project. I have no affiliation with them. I'm not an employee. I'm not an investor. I don't have a financial connection. I'm just an ordinary guy that's very, very interested in the connections between a wide variety of phenomena. So I want to start off, I think, with Kenneth Shoulders, because I think he's a good starting point. There were people working on self-organizing plasmas long before Kenneth Radford Shoulders began his research, but I'm just going to start with him. Basically, Kenneth Shoulders, around the time of 1979, was already a self-taught scientist. He had a very successful career. He had came up with some very important inventions. He had worked for SRI. He was very accomplished. And he is also known as the father of vacuum microelectronics. There's actually, in a museum, I think it was in Pennsylvania, there's a whole archive of his works. So he was a pretty important individual before he ever started his research into EVOs. And I'm going to tell you what that is in a moment. Basically, Kenneth Shoulders decided he wanted to investigate something exotic. So he went to Harold Puthoff, who was already an acquaintance, and they decided to start working together. And Kenneth Shoulders, in his huge garage, he had a house in California with a huge garage attached to it. Maybe it was detached, I'm not certain. And he started working on electrical discharges. And he realized that if you have a sharpened cathode with a sharp little tip, and you have an anode, and you pulse it quickly, that off the tip of the negative cathode, you will get a self-organizing structure. The ions, the electrons, the metal nanoparticles from the little tiny tip exploding. Because remember, at the tip, that's where the electric field is most intense.
For those who don't know, what is a cathode and what's an anode?
Okay, a cathode, if you have, let's say, two ends of a battery, and one's negatively charged and one's positively charged, it's an ordinary battery, and you run a wire from the negative side and you run another wire from the positive side, and then you bring the wires together, and usually this won't create a discharge because the voltage is so low in an ordinary battery. But the piece of wire from the negative side would be considered the cathode, and the piece of wire from the positive side would be considered the anode. And right, basically electrons would be emitted from the negative side or cathode, and they move towards the anode.
So they were using very obviously advanced versions of these in this basement laboratory.
Well, not really. To begin with, it was very, very simple. That's the thing. This technology, what Kenneth Shoulders was doing, especially at first, was extremely simple.
Right.
You know, he said you could produce EVOs, you know, with a nail, an ordinary nail, as a cathode, because, you know, according to Kenneth Shoulders, even if you have a lot of static electricity in your body and you touch a doorknob and there's a discharge, a tiny little EVO for, you know, maybe nanoseconds, microseconds is created. So he started doing research into these discharges. And for example, he would have maybe a sharpened piece of metal. I'm talking very, very small. And then he would have an anode, and he would pulse it. And at the tip,
pulse it with like electrical charge.
Yeah, with electrical energy.
Right.
And, you know, several hundred volts, probably. And there would be a self-organizing structure. Basically, out of the chaos of the positive ions and electrons and tiny metal nanoparticles that would come off the tip when it explodes, because at the sharpened tip of a cathode, this is known science, because the electric field is so intense, it will just vaporize, there would be a self-organizing structure that would form. And he played around with this and played around with this, and he realized that they had many anomalous properties.
So when you say a self-organizing structure, what do you mean exactly by that? So that some of the elements were forming together without a plausible reason?
Well, we're getting there. That's getting ahead of the story a little bit.
Right.
Basically, if you have negative ions, if you have positive ions, and they are in motion. Remember, a magnetic field is produced when you have charged particles in motion. And this magnetic field will begin to move the ions and electrons in specific patterns. And these patterns will start to form loops. And these loops will start to form spirals, and these spirals will start to connect. And then when they connect, they will form more, they will become more like a spheroid. And basically, you get these toruses or spheroids of charged particles, where you have electrons moving around and around and around the exterior, and positive ions in the middle. The best way I can probably describe it, and this is not completely accurate, but this is just a simple way to do it. Imagine a slinky, okay? And right. You connect the ends together. That's basically could be considered very roughly the structure of one of these self-organized systems. And he realized that these basically small self-organizing plasmas that to begin with he thought were simply electrons, and he realized they were a little more complicated and they were carrying along positive ions and other stuff too, but he realized they had many anomalous properties. They, you know, when they struck the anode or a target plate, that, you know, piece of material he put right in front of the anode, they could create characteristic strike marks. They
what
could,
do you mean?
When it hits the metal plate, you could see, for example, ring structures, like right. where the target plate had been damaged or a hole punched in through it. And I'm talking little tiny, you know, he did these experiments on the very, very small scale because he was very conservative and very conscious of safety. So he would produce these track marks. You could see the little indentions in the target plate, and sometimes holes in the target plate. And when they struck, they could release X-rays, because when the EVO struck the target plate, and on many occasions, it would basically, you know, deorganize and self-destruct, and it would release electrons, it could release X-rays, a number of different emissions.
Is an EVO the same thing as a self-organizing plasma? Because you said EVO just then, so I'm just wondering if that's...
Yes. Roughly, you could say an EVO is a self-organizing plasma, but there's more to it than that. And I'm trying to build up and try to get there. You know, an EVO, like Kindler's shoulders, we're playing around with. These are very, very little, small, tiny structures. I mean, we're talking about in single digit to some tens of microns. So we're right. talking about something probably around the thickness of a human hair or smaller. And he had special cameras he had designed to observe them. He had, you know, very sensitive equipment hooked up to measure everything. And of course, he examined everything with scanning electron microscopes and so forth. And he realized these EVOs could be split apart. They could be recombined. When they struck materials, they could induce anomalous effects like non-thermal melting, where very transiently the metal would liquefy and it would re-solidify, but it wasn't due to temperature. And he had ways of calculating that. And he also realized they could induce nuclear transmutations. A transmutation is when you take one element and you transform it into another element. There were isotopic shifts that were produced, if I remember correctly. Also, he realized they could go into a black mode. There was a white mode and a black mode. And the white mode was when they were very energetic. And they were highly interactive with matter. You know, they would do damage, for example, to the target plate I mentioned before. In the black mode, they were stealthy. They were almost invisible. They were very weakly interactive with matter. They could go right through barriers. He also realized, and this is very important, that in, you know, these structures could carve right through matter in the white mode, these EVOs. And what they could do is they like to travel along dielectric interfaces, especially in cracks or intentionally created grooves. And when they did, if the groove was too small for it, it would literally gobble up or absorb the matter, and it would transport it, and then it could deposit it out, spray it out and at another location. And what's so interesting is he claimed
that another location in space and time.
Well, in this example, I'm talking about a very small system. Imagine something the size of a postage stamp. Yeah. And on one side of it, it, you know, it gobbles it up and then it carries it along and deposits it, for example, on the surface of the anode.
Right.
This phenomenon, we're going to get to it later, gets There's so much more potential.
Because that's almost like almost teleportation.
Well, I'm going to get to teleportation later. But basically, in this example, it gobbled up matter, the EVO, and carried it across the little system he built. And, for example, may have deposited it on the anode or the target plate in front of the anode. Now, what's interesting is he claimed that he was able to accelerate these structures, these EVOs, and EVO stands for exotic vacuum object. And he was able to accelerate them for very low energy as if the EVO was negating the mass and inertia of itself and the matter it was carrying. So basically, they're acting like little warp drive generators. So to move on, because I don't want to go through the whole history of Kenneth Shoulders, because that could be an entire interview in and of itself, I want to jump forward to the Sapphire Project.
Absolutely. But first of all, because this actually connects to the Sapphire Project as well, and you highlighted it, is Hal Puthoff was involved with Kenneth Shoulders, correct?
Yes.
With this specific area of research.
Yes. Harold Puthoff worked closely with Kenneth Shoulders for a number of years. He provided the theoretical and scientific review. Kenneth Shoulders was more or less the experimentalist and engineer, and Bell Church of Church's Fried Chicken was basically the financer.
And
And they worked together for many years. At some point down the line, after Kenneth Shoulders moved to Texas, when Earth Tech International was forming originally, there was some kind of falling out that I don't understand completely. I'm not sure anyone outside of those circles do completely understand it. And basically, Kenneth Shoulders started, you know, writing papers on his own, publishing them on the internet, little essays about his technology. What's interesting, if anybody wants to learn more about Kenneth Shoulders, there's a book. It's really available online now. It's called EV, A Tale of Discovery. And there's a little interesting story about it when Kenneth Shoulders was attempting to submit patent applications. The story goes that there was interest by the government to classify his patents and seize them. And to prevent that from happening, he decided to write a book, a story about the entire process of how he developed his technology. So he spent a couple of weeks hurriedly writing it up fast as he could, and he sent out a few dozen copies to friends and colleagues. And when the government found out, they called him up and said, I'm not sure if it was patent office or who it was, they called him up and said, we want a list of everyone you sent the book to. And he basically said the computer ate the list or something of that effect. And they let his patent applications go through. So that book is a really good source of information, EV, A Tale of Discovery. There's actually a very neat picture of Kenneth Shoulders sitting in front of his laboratory with Hal Puthoff and Bill Church next to him, and I believe his son as well, who helped out. And it's a very interesting book, and I encourage people to read it. Also, to fast forward, Hal Puthoff is a consultant, including Eric Davis is as well, a consultant to the Sapphire Project.
Right, yeah.
Let me take a sip of water real quick.
No, that's fine. Yeah, this is what I want to get into now, is the fact that obviously he's displayed this interest through Kenneth Shoulders, and now Harold Puthoff and, as you said, Eric Davis are also involved in the Sapphire Project. So when you're ready, if we could jump into the Sapphire Project, and if you could just let people know, anyone who's listening that has never heard of it before, what exactly is the Sapphire Project and what is their purpose? What are they trying to do?
Okay, the Sapphire Project. I would say, I don't know, 2013, 2012, 2011. I'm not exactly sure of when, but all this information is available online. Some people involved in the electric universe model, that's basically a large number of people online that have an interest in the electrical connection to the universe. You know, they have a number of different theories basically explaining the universe from an electrical perspective, where instead of gravity being the dominant force in the universe, that the universe is actually connected electrically, and that in their theory, the sun is connected through electric currents to other stars, And it's a very interesting theory, but you have to realize the Sapphire Project is not part of the Electric Universe. Basically, the Sapphire Project was commissioned as an independent organization to test the electrical sun model. And to do so, they built a series of devices to basically audit the electrical universe model, because the Sapphire Project is independent of the electrical universe. And so they built a couple of systems. And basically one of their systems, and they had a small model the size of a bell jar. And now they have a larger one, a larger reactor the size of a small car. And it works by, you know, they have two large circular copper electrodes, cathodes specifically, negatively charged with a large surface area. And they have, between the two, they have a spherical anode, which may be hollow in some cases. It does not have to be hollow. It works if it's solid. And it can be composed of many different elements. They've used single isolated elements. They've also used high nickel steel. Now it seems like they're using a tungsten nickel iron alloy, a heavy tungsten alloy. And they've probably tested many different alloys. And basically, they input gas into the chamber at low pressures, probably between 1 and 30 torr, which is a pretty low pressure, but not ridiculously low. And they use a variety of different gases. It seems like they like to use combinations of hydrogen and nitrogen on a regular basis, although they also test hydrogen, nitrogen, and argon. And all of this has connections back to Kendall Scholder's work, but I won't go there right now. And basically, they fire it up with low ripple direct current. The direct current is actually current restricted, so it limits the amount of current that can go through the system. They can control the current and voltage independently of each other. And the voltage is anywhere from 600 to 1500 volts, and they can go anywhere on average, probably from a few amps to 40 amps, depending on which plasma regime they want to produce. And basically, when they fire it up, by controlling precisely the pressure, the voltage, the current, you know, the size of the anode, because they have tested anodes anywhere from an inch and a half, an inch and three quarters, up to around 3 inches, they can create self-organized plasma balls, basically, around the anode. Instead of being, you know, a free-floating EVO, and they don't call their structure an EVO, I'm calling it an EVO, but they call it a self-organizing plasma, which is a perfect description for it. And it starts to self-organize around the anode. And there's different stages of self-organization. For example, at first it would just be little tufts, little balls, plasma balls on the surface of the anode. Then if you increase it a little bit more, the balls start to spin around. Increase it a little bit more, and the balls start to merge with each other. And it kind of looks like the structures on a human brain sort of rippled like spaghetti. And then if you increase it a little bit more, you start getting these double layers. And there's pictures of this online. If you Google the Sapphire Project.
Yeah, I'll have them up as we're talking. Don't worry. I'll make sure that there's a visual aid for everyone listening right now.
You can see these huge double layers. And these double layers are basically layers of positive and negative charge. And they're beautiful. They're brilliant. And then if you increase the current even more, and this is where it gets interesting, these double layers collapse very close to the surface of the anode. And what happens is they get a huge release of energy. And that is when transmutations start to happen on the surface of the anode. Basically, if they use like a pure element for the anode, you know, they can get a sample, you know, they'll get it from a certified source, so they know it's 99.99999% a certain element. Well, after the experiment is done with, they'll have the anode analyzed, and there'll be a dozen different elements on the surface and in the and through the material as well.
I want to say real quick, because you say transmutation, and obviously you're like shifting something from one element to another, but is this in any way programmable, tunable? Like, can they yield a result that they want specifically in terms of, you know, I mean, let's say turning copper into gold, or no, were we not quite there yet?
They're not quite there yet.
But is that what this is potentially yielding? Potentially?
Yeah. It could potentially do that. I mean, they can adjust what transmutation products are produced to a certain extent by, you know, adjusting the input gases and adjusting the material and changing the material of the anode. However, they don't. I don't want to say they have fine control.
No, but this is just the beginning, isn't it? It's literally the beginning of this. This is baby steps. I mean, you think about the NASA computers that were the size of buildings, and now we've got iPhones. So you look at progression, and you can only imagine that within a decade or so, this will be a fundamentally different thing.
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly the case. This is just the beginning. There's so much potential, but to kind of continue, you know, and they can measure, they basically have sent these anodes that have been in the reactor to third party laboratories, okay, that were recommended by companies like Lockheed, by consultants of theirs, because they have a number of different consultants from different prestigious companies and organizations, and they send the anodes to these companies, and they verify everything as well. So it's double check. They detect elements themselves, and the third parties detect these elements. What's also interesting is they have both optical spectrometers and mass spectrometers. Basically, by analyzing the light coming from the reactor, you can determine the composition, you know, what elements are in that gas, what elements are in the atmosphere. And mass spectrometer, and again, I'm not saying that correctly, but I have a little bit of a speech impediment, so I hope people will bear with me. It's difficult for me to pronounce things correctly sometimes. However, but the mass spectrometer analyzes the gas that comes out of the reactor in real time and determines its composition. So we know that there's transmutations happening both the atmosphere, which they can measure in real time, and on the surface of the anode that they measure afterwards. And what's so interesting is these transmutations occur when the plasma ball shrinks and collapses near the surface of the anode, when you get this sharp, sharp voltage gradient near the anode. And at the same time, there is a huge release of energy, and they have measured, for example, they say very high energy UV light coming off of the anode when it's in that mode. And there's electromagnetic emissions and all these different types of emissions basically thermalized down to heat, so they can produce enormous excess heat from their system.
Do they have an overall like a specific mission statement?
Well, what's interesting is obviously they're a commission to verify the electrical sun model, and they claim that none of their results invalidate the electrical sun model. So basically it all matches up. So they satisfied that goal. Now they're working to produce a system that, well, they have a few different goals. They want to produce systems that can transmute nuclear waste. So, for example, they've talked about in the future they could have a reactor next to a conventional fission nuclear reactor that we have lots of already in the world. And they could transmute, let's say, radioactive uranium into something like lead. That would be perfectly safe. So they want to do that. They also want to produce energy generation systems as well, because this process releases a huge amount of energy, and they're progressing as fast as they possibly can. They are continuing to move forward towards building, I think, what they call the Mule, which would be, you know, a prototype experimental commercial reactor. It wouldn't be the final commercial reactor. It'd be a prototype that they would experiment with. And it's, and I really think it's really the future. And there's, I want to say this too. There's a couple other companies I don't want to name, because you have to be careful in this field, that are working on technologies that basically do the same thing, that utilize the same phenomena of a self-organizing plasma that produces transmutations, perhaps extracts energy directly from the vacuum itself, and may induce a wide range of other anomalies.
Are the results at all from this, from the Sapphire project, is it contradictory to anything within mainstream science, or is it being appreciated by the mainstream community when it comes to what they're doing, or is this fringe? Is this considered fringe?
I don't want to consider it fringe, because they have had a significant number of mainstream consultants come in, look at what they're doing, talk with them, and they seem to get along with these people very well, because it seems like they recognize this is real. They're doing real science. This is not pseudoscience. This is legitimate real science. However, the mainstream world, I'm talking about the bulk of the mainstream world, not the relatively small number of people that in the mainstream science world that has interacted with them, but the bulk of the mainstream science world and the mainstream media just haven't caught up yet. That's really the issue. What Sapphire is doing, this is what I believe. This is not what Sapphire has said. I believe what they are doing is producing a macro scale EVO. And it's the large scale version of what Kenneth Shoulders was producing. One difference, of course, is their plasma ball is wrapped around an anode. It's just a different way of doing it, but it's the same basic structure.
Which would basically be like almost like a miniature sun. I mean, one of the staff members I remember watching from a video said it was like bottling the stars.
Yes, it is like, you could consider it that way. You could also consider it one way of generating artificial ball lightning. Ball lightning is a form of lightning fairly rare from one perspective, although some people argue that there's at least a small little ball lightning or self-organizing plasma. This is what Kenneth Shoulders said. Whenever there's a lightning strike, it leads the strike, ionizing the air column for the bolt of lightning to follow. So even if you don't see it, and even if it only exists for a few microseconds, Kenneth Shoulders claimed that every lightning strike produced an EVO. However, what's most typically described as ball lightning is when you have, accounts go basically, someone's inside their house, someone's outside their house, someone's working the field, whatever, and there's a thunderstorm and there's a strike of lightning, or sometimes there's not a strike of lightning, and all of a sudden this plasma ball appears, and it can travel along power lines. It can go and float around in people's houses. Occasionally it has came in contact with people and shocked them. They can go through windows, they can go through solid matter.
Is there a potentiality for there to be a coherence going on there?
Well, here's the thing. What makes EVOs on the small scale that Kenneth Shoulders utilized and on the large scale, what really makes them unique, what makes them special, is that it really does seem in the Sapphire Project has not stated this. Again, this is just me. Kenneth Shoulders made many statements alluding to this. But there are scientists who have written papers that you can go online and find that they claim this as well. The self-organizing plasmas produce coherent matter. Basically, what I think is happening in the Sapphire system, and again, this is just from me. This is not from Sapphire. This is not from anyone connected to Sapphire. In my opinion, what's happening in Kenneth Shoulders EVOs and in Sapphire system and in other reactors from other inventors, there is a layer of coherent matter. Basically, coherent matter is when you take ordinary matter and you turn it into what's called a Bose-Einstein condensate, where every atom in the universe behaves, and not just atoms, electrons too, even photons. They can behave like a particle or a wave. They have both a classical aspect and a quantum mechanical aspect. And for example, if you had a number of electrons, they have wave functions. And if you can get those wave functions to start overlapping, and the wave function is really the essence of what an atom or electron is. If they start to overlap, instead of being individual electrons, they almost become one massive electron. And it's a different state of matter. You see, there's five states of matter. There's gases, that's number one. There's liquids, number two. There's solids, number three. There's plasma, number four. And five, there's these coherent states of matter, or Bose-Einstein condensates. And if you read mainstream science papers, they have in the laboratory, but using complex systems, sometimes cryogenic systems, they have generated Bose-Einstein condensates of electrons, protons.
Are you able to describe what a Bose-Einstein condensate is? Because I have a loose understanding, but it's a bit of a weird term for people who've never heard of it before.
Okay, I'll try to explain this to the best of my ability. Imagine that you have a bunch of atoms in a tiny little reactor, and you super cool them down. And this is skipping a lot, okay? But if you cool them down to near absolute zero, it doesn't always have to be that cold. But if you cool them down, what happens is that the wave function starts to expand. It's called the de Broglie wavelength. And it starts to expand. And when it expands, basically, they kind of merge and become one. The essence of what they are begins to merge, and they become a Bose-Einstein condensate.
Right, right. So it's the overlapping of different wave functions.
Yes, and basically they become, their phases, their quantum phases synchronize. Basically, right. Every atom has quantum states, and when you can synchronize them, for example, the electron orbits, the spin of the electrons, there's a number of different properties, the magnetic moment when you synchronize these, or the energy of these atoms, it gets really complicated. And I cannot say I understand it 100% because there's a lot of advanced math involved that's over my head, but I can grasp the concepts conceptually. Basically.
Sorry, go on.
They merge together and then they have unique properties. They become super fluidic. Basically, they have very, very little viscosity. They gain the ability to become, in some cases, superconducting. So if you run an electrical current with them, there's little to no, if any, electrical resistance. And, you know, it gets very, very deep the more you study this, because there's many, many papers online you can read where scientists, and all these scientists have different little versions of this, talk about space itself, the vacuum being a form of Bose-Einstein condensate. So it gets very deep. I hope that answers your question a little bit.
Yeah, so, but in regards to the coherence, obviously the overlapping of these wave functions eventually forms into something on a macro scale. Is this when some level of coherence comes into play? Is there a...
Yes. In all of these self-organizing plasmas, this is my opinion, when it comes to Sapphire, when it comes to other companies that are producing self-organizing plasmas, when it comes to the EVOs of Kenneth Shoulders, basically there's layers of coherent matter created. And I believe that it's this coherent matter, these Bose-Einstein condensates that may have superconducting properties. Because remember, even with Sapphire, and this doesn't absolutely 100% prove that there's a layer of coherent matter there, because plasmas are typically very, very good electrical conductors anyway. But when they put a specially made probe, attach it to, or bring it in contact with the innermost double layer of their system when they have the self-organizing plasma there. They measure little to no electrical resistance. They basically, it's so low they can't measure it. And so that might be a sign of superconductivity. Doesn't prove it, but it might be. And so I believe that it's this superconducting coherent layer that allows for, you know, I don't like to use this term, allows for all the magic to happen, that allows for the transmutations, the isotopic shifting, allows for the excess energy production, the zero point energy tapping. You know, and Sapphire has actually hinted at Montgomery Childs, which is their director. He has hinted in at least a couple interviews, and it's mentioned in one of their presentations scrolling down the screen, that they believe they have observed the shielding of gravity within their double layers, but they have never went into it in depth.
Well, this is where the conversation kind of bleeds into the UFO discussion, because we're looking at potentially a technology that has applications that seem to, at least in the more advanced stages of utilizing this technology, seems to be able to produce the same capabilities that we're seeing observed by UFOs. Is that correct? Or does that seem to be the projection of this type of technology?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. Even Kenneth Shoulders, in some of his writings and essays, described how a object or craft that was enshrouded in basically EVOs could potentially, you know, defy gravity. But I really think that all of this was figured out a long time ago, and I want to try to stay on topic, but I will just skip ahead a little bit to say that if you look up the Fluxliner ARV, which stands for Alien Reproduction Vehicle, which is a long story, there's a great documentary about it called the Fluxliner Zero Point, the Fluxliner ARV. You can look that up on YouTube. It allegedly utilized a self-organizing plasma in the interior, which produced a field around the craft that basically allowed it to, you know, nullify gravity and propel itself. You know, the key is this. Yes, these self-organizing plasmas probably block, you know, shield gravity, but they also seem to have a unique capability of manipulating the vacuum. And so the fields they produce are unique, and you can use these fields to wrap around a craft and use that to propel yourself.
Could the transmutational properties as well of the EVO phenomena, do you think that could be responsible in any way for the creation of some of the extremely anomalous metamaterials that have been ejected from craft or retrieved from crash sites?
Well, if I had to guess about those metamaterials, and again, there's many different classes of alleged metamaterials, and we have more proof when it comes to some of them. When I say we, I don't mean me personally. I'm not involved with metamaterials. But those that have been researching it, they have proof that some of them came from something anomalous, and other ones, they don't have absolute proof. But in many cases, what happens is people see a luminous, bright, glowing object, and it seems like material that is ejected from it. And this material is basically almost like a gel. It's very soft. It's putty-like. And then it solidifies, and they collect it. And that is basically what many researchers have in their possession. And what's interesting is that if you study this whole field of EVOs and the different players involved, you realize that it's very possible that material could be basically fuel that was ejected from the craft itself, because if it's utilizing a self-organizing plasma to generate power, there's going to be transmutations. I really think that's unavoidable. And eventually, over time, you may need to put fresh matter in to the reactor that's powering one of these systems, because if you need, let's say, a certain ratio of isotopes or a certain ratio of elements to begin with, And over time, that changes. You know, if you're going to put new fresh fuel in into the plasma, you might have to eject some out first. And when you eject it, it could turn into, you know, some of this metamaterial stuff that has been collected. There's other possibilities as well, because, you know, some of these UFOs probably have an interior self-organizing plasma, you know, in an interior column or reactor, and the field is directed around the craft. But other vehicles that have been recovered may possibly utilize, and again, I don't think we have absolute confirmation of this, may utilize nano-layered materials. For example, the bismuth, magnesium, zinc layered material that Linda Moulton Howe gave to TTSA. It's possible that EVOs are traveling through the nanolayers in that material. For example, bismuth is diamagnetic, and it could act as a waveguide for EVOs that could circle around and around and around the craft and basically be enshrouding the craft in a large-scale EVO.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because there's an interview, and I've got to try and find it again, because it was done by Linda Moulton Howe, and she was interviewing someone who was who was claiming to be an S4 physicist of some description. And he was talking about the magnesium bismuth zinc material, and he was saying something extremely similar, just in regards to how some of the material acted as essentially a waveguide for the drive energy. And, you know, that it was allowing it to become weightless. I can't give the science because I'm not versed on it. But it was an interesting discussion that she had with this guy, because he really did seem to know his stuff when he was talking about it quite confidently. And it was quite similar to what you just said then, especially in regards to some of these materials acting as waveguides for this energy.
There's a multitude of different ways to engineer this. And I'm sure different ET species or different factions of the same extraterrestrial species have engineered this in many different ways. I believe the simplest way to do it would be the Fluxliner ARV design. When I say the simplest, I should mean it's not necessarily the simplest, but the first method that humans would probably figure out. But then I believe later on, it's possible that humans figured out how to replicate these, you know, the versions of it that use these nano-layered metamaterials that could act as waveguides. So there's probably many different variations.
Do you feel like there's, just to kind of jump onto the, unless you want to cover the Sapphire project a little bit more, is there anything else you want to dive into there?
They are moving ahead rapidly. They're making very fast progress. They are gaining a lot of interest in certain circles. And I think that, you know, people need to pay a lot of attention to what they're doing, because I believe that what they are doing could be the emergence of basically the same technology, you know, ETs use in some of their craft, but it's emerging without reverse engineering. We're figuring it out on our own. And they don't talk about reverse engineering or UFOs or aliens or anything like that. And they're not claiming this is alien technology. I want to make that clear. I don't want to put any words in their mouth. But I believe this is the same phenomena that's used by ET craft. And it's just really exciting to me that it's beginning to emerge, because this technology is the link to a wide range of different phenomena. And later on, not this moment, but later on this interview, I've prepared a couple statements, basically just organizing my thoughts a little more coherently, no pun intended, about these topics and what this technology truly represents. And I'll give those statements if you will allow me to do so later on. Let's move on to what you want to talk about next.
Do you think we need to worry about the Sapphire Project at all, in just regards to the fact that obviously within the UFO community specifically, there's quite a lot of paranoia about breakthrough energy propulsion systems and ideas that get blackballed or, you know, hidden away in projects or classified under a national security law? Do you think we're in a different time period now and we don't need to worry so much, or is there still that risk with something like Sapphire?
I think there's still a little risk. However, I also believe we are in a different time period. I believe things have changed to a certain degree. But most importantly, I believe that there's so much information out now that they can't put the genie back in the bottle. They can't suppress this fundamental knowledge of how to do this. What the Sapphire Project is doing is super simple. There's very little secret sauce. I mean, the basic concept of what they're doing is simple. You know, I mentioned it earlier. You basically have two large circular cathodes of large surface area. You have an anode in between. That anode can be solid. It doesn't have to be hollow. That anode, you know, typically in some cases, they utilize a tungsten alloy. For example, tungsten nickel iron alloy. Then you put in various ratios of just ordinary nitrogen and ordinary hydrogen. And the hydrogen does not have to be deuterium, which is an isotope of hydrogen. It can just be ordinary hydrogen. Then you feed in direct current, you know, at reasonable voltages. Like I said, in some cases, it might be between 600 and 1500 and anywhere from a few to 40 amps, you know, depending on the size of the anode. With a smaller anode, you have a greater electron concentration around the anode, so you don't need as many amps. And then you just adjust it, and you gradually de-restrict the current, and you'll go through all these various plasma regimes. You'll get the big, beautiful double layers, then you increase it a little bit more, and it collapses, and you see this bright, beautiful orange ball tightly around the surface of the anode. And I believe that's when the coherent matter forms, and you create this superconducting layer, and that's when the transmutations happen and the excess energy is produced. So it's very, very simple. You can't put this back in the bottle. The information is out, and there's multiple companies. They use different terminology. They describe their technology in different ways. They, you know, they have their own theories. And you know, the good thing about the Sapphire Project is they try not to be bound by any one theory. They're very, you know, they said, you know, I like the fact that they, you know, don't have just one pet theory that they, you know, push. No, you know, they admit they don't understand everything, and they admit that there may need to be a brand new field of science to completely understand this. But the good thing is you don't have to understand every little detail of what's happening at the atomic level and at the quantum level to make it work.
I think this is the main takeaway, which is really encouraging, is that this can be done at a relatively grassroots level for a pretty modest budget, you know, if anyone basically had a lab in their backyard.
I mean, it's very simple. I mean, people in the past, for the last 100 years, if you study exotic technologies and the different systems that have been produced, you know, and there's many reasons why some of these systems didn't get commercialized. I mean, I won't go into all of that right now. But this technology in different implementations have been discovered, produced, and then lost or forgotten over and over again. But now I believe we really understand it better than ever before. This is really the key to all cold fusion, or LENR. That stands for low energy nuclear reaction. This is the same primary mechanism that happens in those classical cold fusion systems, except with Sapphire, this is a pure plasma-based system. And these pure plasma-based systems, I believe, are the way to go. I was also going to surprise you with something you may find very interesting. Talking about coherent matter, talking about what's possible, because some people might say, oh, this coherent matter stuff, he's just, you know, hallucinating. This is pseudoscience. This is nonsense, blah, 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 blah. Well, there's a patent that's assigned to Lockheed Martin. One of the inventors assigned to this patent was a big wig in Lockheed Skunk Works. He was a very senior engineer there, or scientist. And the title of the patent, it's called Systems and Methods for Generating Coherent Matter Wave Beams. And basically, okay, he describes how his device is complicated. It's not utilizing a very simple system. like sapphires. And I really think, and I'm just guessing here, I don't know for certain, but I'm really guessing that this patent is, you know, if they patent something like this, they had it 30, 40 years already.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In the black world. And I think this is an intentional overcomplication in right. this patent. But I think they allow this patent to go through just to plant some ideas in the outside world. But basically, it describes how you can use the magnetic vector potential, which is another topic we can discuss later if you want, a magnetic vector potential to cohere or form Bose-Einstein condensates out of matter and photons. And just to, and I want to read his little description of what this can do.
Is this online, by the way? Before you do that, is this online? Can you send me a link? And I'll put it in the description so everyone listening.
I'll send you a link.
Yeah, everyone listening, there'll be a link in the description box below.
It's called Systems and Methods for Generating Coherent Matter Wave Beams. Okay? And I'm just going to read a little short portion of it. Matter wave coherence for streaming particles may open the door to many new technologies and many new applications. Matter wave particles carry mass, and thus the potential for concentrating energy to densities far beyond what massless photons are capable of may be much higher. Furthermore, coherent matter waves may allow fermions, e.g. electrons, as well as bosons, e.g. photons, to achieve coherence. Examples of applications for coherent matter wave beams may include single bath thermal energy extraction, ultra-sensitive accelerometers, and interferometric tracking of air spacecrafts, a more accurate alternative to global positioning systems, matter wave projectiles and missiles, directed energy weapons, matter wave optics and cloaking, matter wave emission and propulsion, matter wave solitons, high energy collisions, high precision matter optics, atomic clocks, test of physics constants, and other suitable applications.
Wow, that's a lot of different applications right there.
Yes, and you have to realize, I believe the whole purpose of this patent was just to get a few basic ideas out there.
Right, and maybe a bit like the Navy patents by Salvatore Pi.
Yes, exactly. And I believe with those Navy patents, and when I say this about him, I think he's a completely honest, sincere scientist.
Is that Salvatore?
Salvatore.
Yeah.
But I also believe they pushed his patents and let them get out there because they knew it introduced a concept. My personal opinion of his patents is that they're overcomplicated. They're basically needlessly complex, and that there's more direct, more simple ways of doing what he describes, but they push them out there to get the concepts in the mainstream. And I believe that's what they did with this Lockheed patent, Systems and Methods for Generating Coherent Matter Wave Beams. I believe it's the same thing. They're trying to plant these ideas in the outside world because they have mastered this technology for many decades.
You might be right there. I'm sorry to interrupt you there, but you might be right because, you know, the very fact that they're putting out these patents, which, like you said, do seem to contain legitimate science, but perhaps overly convoluted, it would suggest a couple of things, really, because you're only going to put out something like that, even if it is convoluted and it's not as simple as perhaps the own systems you're working on yourself, the patents that you're using in your own programs. If it's actionable, you're giving that to a foreign adversary. You know, there is huge amounts of counterintelligence work done on a daily basis. There, you know, Russia and China and America, they're continually scanning things that are coming out of each other's countries to find out what's going on. So there's no way that they wouldn't become aware, foreign adversaries wouldn't become aware of patents that have been released. So you have to imagine that if the Navy and other entities like Lockheed are going to release very novel patents that represent a paradigm shifting propulsion system or anything like this, that it's either completely wrong, which doesn't seem to be the case, but if that's not the case and it is actually an actionable technology, but it's just more convoluted, that would pretty much directly mean exactly what you just said, which is that they've had these things for a long time, because there is the only reason you would release something, even if it is more complicated and would take whoever sees it longer to figure out, the only reason you would release something like that is because you've already got the ace in the hole.
Exactly. I totally agree, 100%. I was going to state that the Fluxliner ARV, was likely built in the late 1950s, early 1960s, at the latest, the first models of the Fluxliner.
Do you feel there's suitable evidence for the Fluxliner?
Absolutely. I believe it.
Do you want to kind of go through it for anyone that might not know, just in case they're doubting what that could be? Do you want to just give a little bit of an overview of why people might have heard of the Fluxliner?
To give a little background on the Fluxliner, Mark McCandlish was a graphics designer. He made artwork for the covers of magazines like Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, and he did other jobs as well in graphic design. And he had a friend named Brad Sorensen. And Brad Sorensen basically invited him to an air show, I believe, at Norton Air Force Base. And this was in the late 80s, I believe, around 1987, might have been 88. And he went to this air show. His friend went to the air show. He couldn't because he got a job, a rush job. They needed a cover for a magazine over the weekend, and he couldn't turn down the money that they were offering him. It was like a couple $1,000s. And back then, that was a significant amount, and he couldn't turn it down. So his friend went to this air show, and it was just a mainstream air show where anybody could attend. But then he went on an airplane with a friend of his that was apparently some kind of official in the Department of Defense. And they went to Lockheed's big hangar in Palmdale. I think it's called Air Force Plant 42, I believe. It's the big hangar they have. And he went there and he saw these different craft, more conventional type craft, exotic, experimental, but more conventional. Then they pulled back a curtain, and there's these three hovering, roughly saucer-shaped objects. But they were man-made. And there was a general there describing the craft. There were cutaway drawings of the craft. Some of the panels off the bottom were actually removed so you could see inside. And basically, the guy who took him there said, "Hey, just be quiet. Don't talk to anybody. Just listen, enjoy it, and we'll get out of here really fast." So he saw everything, and apparently Brad Sorensen told investigators, because after all this, Mark McCandlish at first, and then Mark McCandlish with people like Hal Putoff and Gordon Neville and Bert Rutan and a few others formed a loosely knit, effort to research this. It wasn't like a tight organization, but they were working together to try to get the bottom of this.
Well, specifically the Fluxliner.
Yeah, the Fluxliner.
Right.
And for example, Bradford Sorensen was interviewed, I believe, by Gordon Neville, I believe by Hal Putoff as well. And of course, by Mark McCandlish, who was his friend that talked with him repeatedly. And basically, the reason Lockheed was showing this was to pitch the idea for a run of 30 of these vehicles. And remember, the smallest one was about 30 feet in diameter. The next one was like 80 feet in diameter, maybe butchering this a little. And the largest one was like 150 feet in diameter. The Baby Bear, Mama Bear, and Papa Bear, they were nicknamed. And basically it was a pitch to certain chairmen of Senate committees for a run of 30 of these vehicles, of the Papa Bear, the largest model, as an instantaneous nuclear deployment system. And that's why they were showing them off. Anyway, and so he goes and after the whole thing, calls Mark McCandlish, tells him about it. They work together, and Mark McCandlish comes up with a drawing and the diagram that's online.
I subsequently called my congressman from that district. I called his office. This was Congressman George E. Brown Jr., who at the time was the chairman of the Congressional Committee on Space Science and Advanced Technology. I naturally assumed that since this presentation that Brad talked about was for top military brass and certain congressional individuals, that his office must have coordinated this with the local Air Force Office of Public Affairs. A male staff member in Congressman Brown's office not only confirmed the exhibit, but the fact that there were three discs at that exhibit. These discs were hovering off the floor without any visible means of support. They were referred to as alien reproduction vehicles, also nicknamed the Flux Liner because they used high voltage electricity. Let's see. To keep things short, shortly after he had his sighting and subsequently cleaned that drawing up and made it much more accurate, and that's the drawing that Dr. Greer is holding there now. June of 1967, I later spoke to a gentleman by the name of Kent Sellen that I met at an air show at Edwards Air Force Base in 1992, the first unveiling publicly of the B-2 bomber. He indicated to me that in 1973, when he was a crew chief working on experimental aircraft at Edwards Air Force Base, that he had unintentionally wandered into an area where there was a classified aircraft, namely the ARV. He described it in detail, and he added other details to the account concerning the configuration and the operation of the vehicle that Brad Sorensen was not aware of. Subsequently, Brad Sorensen met with the famous aeronautical designer Burt Rutan, gave him a copy of this blueprint, which you've just been shown. Mr. Rutan felt that it was a joke and put it on his wall as kind of a joke. And a third party confirmed for me later that a Colonel Ray Walsh from Edwards Air Force Base was visiting Mr. Rutan, saw this this blueprint on the wall and registered quite a degree of shock and anger, wanted to know where the hell he got this blueprint, because there was, in fact, such a craft at that time, approximately 1994-95, in a hangar at Edwards Air Force Base, North Base Complex at that time. Subsequently, I've done a lot of research on this product, this vehicle. I've come across a number of declassified documents that show that the Air Force, as early as 1960, was wind tunnel testing flying saucer shapes up to Mach 20. And I also have declassified NASA documents that show similar shapes. In fact, this is the document here that more or less details the wind tunnel testing up to Mach 20. This is the NASA document right here that was declassified, and it shows a variety of spherical and lenticular shapes that were flight tested up to, or I should say wind tunnel tested up to Mach 6. I subsequently obtained a copy of an interoffice memo from Hercules Aerospace that describes a particular type of science involving something called zero-point energy and scalar waves. According to Brad Sorensen, this is the basis of the technology for these anti-gravity propulsion systems. This particular document here describes six different meetings involving the Defense Intelligence Agency and cooperative efforts with the Russian scientific community in investigating this what is called the fundamental enabling technology that was originally discovered apparently by Nikola Tesla in the early 1900s. Anyway, I could provide you much more detail at a later time, and I am prepared to testify in detail concerning these events and their truthfulness before Congress. Thank you very much.
A very detailed description.
Yeah, it's an amazing drawing. It is an amazing drawing. I'm just wondering, though, how did that guy manage to get in there? I mean, he had no... He didn't have the clearances or anything.
Okay, the way I've heard it described is that very frequently senior level DOD officials, like very high senior level officials, will have like assistants that have high clearances as well. Because if you're a high level DOD person, you can't do all the work by yourself. You have to have someone to copy things, deliver things, fax things, you know, prepare papers and statements, and that person has to have a high security clearance. But it would be And from the way I've heard it described, it would be common for a high DOD official to travel with such an assistant.
Right.
And basically, it seems like this official was confident that they would just assume that Brad Sorensen was with him, that it was his assistant, that he was cleared when he really wasn't.
So the senior official or the assistant?
The senior official, the DOD official, apparently, that he was traveling with, that Brad Sorensen was probably hoping that the people at Lockheed
just assumed that he had the tickets.
Yeah, just assumed that Brad Sorensen had the tickets when he really didn't.
Right. Okay.
You see what I'm saying? And I've heard that was fairly commonplace. So I guess this guy was high up enough. He thought he could take the chance, and if he got busted, they might kick him out. You might kick Brad Sorensen out or something.
Yeah, yeah.
But it would be a total disaster, you know. But apparently he got in. But after all of this, you know, even after they made that drawn with Mark McCandless, you know, after he was interrogated by Gordon Neville, and I think he underwent a polygraph and interrogation and everything else, Mark McCandless continued to research it, and he found multiple other witnesses, at least two, I believe maybe three, that saw the Flux liner, the same craft of the same description in other contexts. And some of this is in the documentary Zero Point, the Flux Liner ARV. And that's part of the evidence. Mark McCandless has other evidence too. And I don't want to go into all of that right now, but if you watch that documentary, you will see the bulk of the evidence, but there's even more. And when you look at it from a physics perspective, for example, I have been told that allegedly the Flux Liner ARV utilized a specific isotope of mercury. Mercury isotope 199. You know, an isotope is the same element with a different number of neutrons. And different isotopes can have different properties. And so this specific isotope, when I looked it up online, looked at the properties, I realized mercury 199 would be ideal for generating a self-organized plasma. There's a lot of unique aspects of it, and not just mercury 199. There's some specific advantages to that isotope. For example, it has a positive magnetic moment, and there's different things about it, but just mercury in general, mercury has a high mass. And can the shoulders realize that EVOs formed more readily when you had a combination of a light, for example, a light gas, let's say hydrogen, mixed in with a heavier gas. And William Bostick, who was someone that Kenneth Shoulders communicated with that had done research into self-organizing plasmas, and there's different names for self-organizing plasmas. William Bostick was famous for doing a lot of research into what's called plasmoids, which is just another term for self-organizing plasma. And he discovered that, you know, a mixture of a heavier gas with a lighter gas would optimize these self-organizing plasmas. And what's so neat about mercury is that it very easily vaporizes. You know, it has, I believe, one of the lowest melting temperatures of any metal. And so you can vaporize it very easily. So the Flux Liner ARV utilized a central core of mercury 199, and it created a self-organizing plasma ball, which I believe at the core, this is what makes an EVO unique, is that it had the coherent matter in a layer around the core. And that layer of coherent matter seems to be the key to interacting with the vacuum to manipulate gravity and mass and inertia.
I think it's important for people to understand the distinction, because coherent matter doesn't necessarily mean conscious matter.
No. Coherent matter does not mean conscious matter. Coherent means, okay, if you have a lot of atoms, let's say you have a group of ordinary atoms, in a sample, they're not coherent. They're going to have different energies. Their electrons might not all be at the same level. Some of the atoms may be so-called excited other atoms may not be excited. They may have slightly different magnetic moments. They're not, they're individual entities, okay? A group of coherent atoms means that these quantum mechanical properties have aligned, they have synchronized, and that the de Broglie wavelength, which is the wave function of these atoms or electrons or photons, have combined. They're overlapping. So you have a collection of atoms or electrons or photons which have the same properties. They have the same energy. They can have, the same quantum states. You know, they're called degenerate matter because they're all the same. If you have a hunk of a Bose-Einstein condensate anywhere you measure in that hunk of Bose-Einstein condensate or coherent matter, it would have the exact same quantum properties. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, everything's aligned.
Yes, everything is aligned. That's the best way of saying it. So instead of having, from one point of view, instead of having a million individual particles, you have one large quantum particle. So that's the best way to describe it. And it's this specific state of matter that seems to be capable of manipulating the vacuum most efficiently. And Eugene Podkletnov, who is a Russian researcher who has been dabbling in gravity control for decades now, he has built a number of different systems that can manipulate gravity in different ways. He had a spinning superconductive disk that could produce a reduction in gravity above it. Then he developed a larger system where it was basically a huge version. And again, it wasn't exactly like this, but imagine a superconducting version of a Kenneth Shoulders EVO generator. And so he would have, this is Eugene Podkletnov, the Russian researcher. He would have a superconducting cathode, and he would have an ordinary material for an anode. And this was a large system. And all of this was within, I believe, liquid helium or liquid nitrogen, I believe, to keep it all cold. So the superconducting disk would be below what's called the critical temperature, below which superconductivity happens in these materials. And this was a very special superconductor he made himself. And allegedly, when he would pulse the system with millions of volts, you know, compared to the few hundred maybe Kenneth Shoulders typically worked with, he would create basically a plasma ball would come out of the cathode, shoot towards the anode, and when it struck the anode, there would be a beam of force projected. And sometimes it would be weaker and it would just move a pendulum, but other times, if they ramped the voltage high enough, Podkletnov claimed that it could punch through brick walls.
Wow.
And it could travel for kilometers, and that it would not lose strength over kilometers of travel, and it would stay focused. It wouldn't become diffuse over kilometers. He also did measurements that seemed to indicate it was traveling at a minimum of 64 times the speed of light. And yes, all this sounds extreme, but when you really start to dig in to these technologies that have been worked on, and you start digging into these concepts of coherent matter and superconductivity and superfluidic substances, and bring it all together with the EVO phenomenon, you start to realize that all of this is indeed real. This is possible.
Was Nikolai Tesla involved in the EVO phenomena at all?
Well, yes, he was. He didn't call them EVOs, obviously. He had his own lingo, and that's one big problem in this field. Every scientist, every researcher that dabbles in this, you know, 100 years ago to today, utilizes their own terminology, their own personal lingo to describe their systems and their technology and everything involved with it. And it makes it difficult to compare and contrast different exotic technologies. But if you do the research, if you spend enough time looking at these different technologies and comparing them, you realize that virtually every single exotic technology over the last 100 years or longer that has been developed, utilized EVOs, self-organizing plasmas, and coherent matter. And one example of what Tesla was doing is in his spark gaps. In many of his Tesla coils, he utilized a spark gap. He would have a cathode, and he would have an anode. And he would pulse it with electricity, often from a capacitor bank that was built into the circuit. And he would try to pulse it for the shortest duration possible because he didn't want a constant current arc. That's the key with Kinless Shoulder systems and some of these other systems. And there's different ways of producing EVOs. So this is just one way. Like with Kinless Shoulders, he did not want a current arc. He pulsed it very rapidly. He wanted to pulse it just long enough to form a VVO, an EVO, and cut it off. And that's what Kinless Shoulders did. That's what Tesla did. After he pulsed his spark gap, it was called the disruptor. He would try to disrupt the arc with flowing gas, with magnetic fields. He would even have spinning spark gaps in some of his devices, his Tesla coils, because he wanted to launch the spark and then cut it off so you don't waste energy. And that was an EVO right there. Also, the so-called Tesla death ray that has been talked about by so many people for so long. What do you think this Lockheed patent is? The systems and method for generating coherent matter wave beams. That's the Tesla death ray.
Well, it said directed energy weapons in the patent description, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It said, and I will read that part again, and this is from the patent, systems and methods for generating coherent matter wave beams. And it gives the example. This is directly from the patent, matter wave projectiles and missiles, directed energy weapons. So, and if you read deeper into the patent, it talks about how a device like this could project energy potentially millions of times greater than that of a laser, because a laser is coherent photons. Okay. This is talking not only about coherent photons, but also coherent matter, electrons, for example, and ions. And that can, and a photon has no mass. An electron has mass. An ion has a lot more mass than an electron. So they could carry far more energy. And in this coherent state, it would become even more energetic. And the math is provided in this patent. So Tesla was utilizing the EVO phenomenon, even though he didn't use that terminology.
I would like to segue a little bit into present day, if that's all right with you, because there's so much going on right now. And if we're going to base it off of what we've just been talking about in regards to the steps that have been made in the black world, in the special access program world, when it comes to exotic technologies and propulsion systems, and perhaps we have actual craft that have been fully created and are, operational. If we're working from that potential reality, when it comes to what we're seeing right now, I guess what's the most notable piece of news is this. Well, it's not 180 days now. It's like 163, I believe. But the countdown to the multi-agency all-source intelligence report that has come from the Senate Intelligence Committee, spearheaded by Marco Rubio. Basically, for those that, I'm pretty sure everyone knows about this by now, but for those that aren't aware, basically Senator Marco Rubio, alongside the Senate Intelligence Committee, inserted an attachment onto the Authorization Act for fiscal year 2021, which included some language about the UAP issue, basically asking for a multi-agency all-sources report on pertinent information about the UFO issue. And so a lot of people are seeing this now as almost the countdown to disclosure. So I want to know what you think about this.
Well, I have two main fears about this report. And again, I'm hopeful. I would love it if this brought about total full disclosure of everything. And although it potentially could, I think it's very unlikely. And I'm going to tell you why. But first, I want to say what I expect. My guess, and I hope I'm wrong, I hope we get a lot more, but my guess is at most we will get the information that ATIP collected. You know, videos, radar data, and so forth of a number of UAPs. Remember, very early on, maybe in 2016, 2017, Lou Elizondo was asked how many of these videos exist. And he basically indicated there were dozens, there were many, and that the best ones we had not even seen. And so I'm certain ATIP has a huge number of videos that are would be very compelling. However, I'm not really overly interested in videos of objects flying in the sky. Such videos are fascinating. They're extremely interesting, and they're potentially very useful. However, they will not bring an end to the UFO cover-up. The only thing that will bring an end to the cover-up, that will bring disclosure, that will end this atrocity, that is the UFO cover-up, is basically admission of crash recoveries and successful reverse engineering. There's a huge difference between a video of an object flying in the sky, even if there's, you know, radar data, even if there's witnesses on the ground watching. We've had that since the 60s or the 50s or the 40s. There have been amazing UFO encounters that are documented. But there's a huge difference even between the best encounter in the sky and a physical UFO on the ground that can be examined by scientists, analyzed with bodies, with beings, either dead or alive. That's proof. That's undeniable. That's game over for the cover-up. That is the beginning of disclosure. Okay. One, Lou Elizondo, I believe he's a great person in a lot of ways. Okay. He's a hero for the sacrifices he has made. He's a hero for how much energy and time he has put in to ATIP with very little reward, financially or otherwise. He has sacrificed a lot. However, he claims disclosure has already happened. It has not. It has not. Disclosure doesn't begin until there's the admission to crash recoveries and the reverse engineering of the technology. Once that happens, boom, that's when a new age begins. That's when a new era of mankind starts.
Well, do you think that they're in any way trying to build to that eventual announcement? I mean, you know, one could argue that the creation of To the Stars Academy and the mechanism put in place, there's been this slow step-by-step, drip-by-drip progress, which not everyone enjoys, admittedly. Well, but do you think that that's what they're building to eventually, or do they need to change direction?
I don't want to skip your question because I was trying to answer your previous question.
Yeah, of course. No, please.
Keep that in mind. Keep that
yes.
in mind.
Yes.
And so crash recoveries is the absolute proof we want. However, with this report that's supposed to come out in less than 180 days now, my two greatest fears are as follows. Number one, government agencies, branches of the military, the DOD, the intelligence community. Number one, the minority of these people that have the full truth, okay, that are aware of crash recoveries, are aware of reverse engineering, that have more than just, you know, cool videos. I mean, the groups that really are in control of this, I don't think they're going to share. I don't think they're going to share what they really have and what they really know. And they'll be, and I don't know if there's any way to really force them to admit to what they have. You know, for example, if there's some kind of, you know, if there's, and I'm going to say MJ-12. We don't really know what the UFO control organization is called these days, but I'm just going to say MJ-12. If there's still a branch of MJ-12 in the CIA, for example, or the NSA, I don't believe they're just going to say, okay, let's send them what we got. No, they're not. I don't think they're going to do that. I would love it.
Another concern is the fact that some of this, if not most of it, could be entirely in the private contract world.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah,
exactly. It's
impenetrable to basically any sort of government insight.
Well, the first issue, and I want to finish this off real quick, and I'm going to get to the commercial aspect, is that I would love for these insiders within the NSA, the CIA, these different intelligence communities to realize everything needs to be put on the table. It's time for an end to the cover-up. It's time to just tell the complete truth about Roswell, Aztec, all the other crash recoveries, the reverse engineering, the amazing technologies. It's time to just, you know, abandon the secrecy and put it out there. I would love that, but I don't think it's likely, although I think it should happen. The other fear I have is that, especially since the end of the Admiral Wilson saga, after he basically discovered where some of this was being hidden and what companies, most likely it was Lockheed, that they buried it even more deeply. I believe most likely, I won't say all, but I would say the vast majority of what we want is locked away in these private corporations. And I'm not going to say they're impenetrable, because if we have evidence of where they are, then if the Senate and Marco Rubio and others on his committee are willing to play hardball, they could threaten not to approve any future contracts to these private corporations until they do reveal everything and transfer everything to the official government. You know, I would love it if they said, hey, look, Lockheed, if you don't transfer, when I say Lockheed, I should include other, I don't believe it's just Lockheed. I believe there's probably been a number of different aerospace corporations.
Yeah, Battelle seems to be the popular one at the
Battelle
moment.
And others, you know, there's probably been others too. Battelle's one of them that have been involved. If you don't transfer all the materials we have given you, you know, including the craft, the bodies, the wreckage, the technological devices, the whole nine yards, if you don't transfer it back to us, then we will simply never buy another jet or fighter or bomber or piece of software.
I guess, can I cut it real quick
and ever again?
And just say, I guess the issue there would be obviously the military industrial complex and the need to profit. And you've got these spearhead contractors. The reason that they're spearhead contractors is because they net billions and billions for these countries. So I couldn't imagine the US government giving Lockheed Martin an ultimatum on this that would result in them no longer having a contract simply just because of the amount of money they make from these contractors.
I believe it's possible, because
I'd like to think so.
The majority of congressmen and senators, I'm not going to say all, I believe the majority of them, the vast majority of them, including Marco Rubio, probably are clueless about what's really happened over the last 70, 80 years when it comes to the UFO reality. Yeah. And if all of a sudden, you know, it was made crystal clear to them, there have been crash recoveries, the flux liner is real, the TR-3B or other black triangle craft were indeed built, but Lockheed is not letting them know, or other companies, you know, whether it's Northrop Grumman, whether it's some other corporation, Battelle, or just keeping that technology from them and basically selling the U.S. military, you know, the equivalent of Stone Age technology.
Yeah, bogus chemical propulsion systems. Yes. I can see what you mean. In that regard, if there was that catalyst, that realization of these things being real, that could definitely push that sort of ultimatum forward.
Because I would love to see Marco Rubio, you know, summon some representatives from these companies into his office and see Marco slam his fist down. Actually, I would love to see this on camera in Senate hearings, saying, if you have this technology, by God, we want it, because we're not going to be using, you know, Newtonian propulsion for another 100 years. You know, I mean, it's just, and it's really, just imagine, we've had people die in the space shuttle program. Okay. You know, basically you sit on top of a huge chemical rocket and you hope it doesn't explode and you go off into orbit. Just imagine if over the last 50, 60 years, the space program could have utilized anti-gravity. And I don't like the term anti-gravity because it's not very precise.
No, it's a simplification.
But could have used craft that could manipulate gravity, mass, and inertia to travel anywhere around the solar system or beyond. I mean, it could have
been a thing. I mean, we've had so many different advancements in technology in different sectors, and pretty much everything in our lives has advanced. You know, there's only a few things. I mean, the coat hangers in my wardrobe, they haven't really advanced. You know, we've got a few things that we still maintain, but most technology has advanced, and yet propulsion has pretty much stayed the same, and energy has pretty much stayed the same for over 100 years.
Yep, propulsion and energy have pretty much stayed the same.
That should make people question things. That should make people very suspicious.
And let me and continue on these lines, but I want to come back in a minute to the finishing the answer to your question.
Please.
But just let's put ourselves in the position of the military, okay, before this got transferred over to the private sector, okay? Let's put ourselves in the position of the military in the late 40s, early 50s. You have fleets of UFOs flying over Washington, D.C. You have headlines in newspapers about fleets of flying discs flying over multiple other cities in the United States. There were sightings happening all the time, all over the country. And you realize they are stopping on a dime. They're accelerating to insane speeds. They are making sharp right-hand turns. They're moving faster than any conventional rocket. They are doing things that are completely non-Newtonian. And to have their performance characteristics, they had to be manipulating the vacuum. They must be utilizing some form of gravity modification, or otherwise the occupants would basically be splattered and be transformed into a pile of goo just due to the G-forces, okay? What do you think they would do? You know what? Let's just keep working on jet fighters for the next 50 years. Let's put all of our money into that and ignore what's in their skies. No way. They would have put a lot of resources, a lot of money into trying to figure out how those flying saucers operate, to how to replicate their performance, to how to manipulate these fundamental forces like gravity, mass, and inertia here on Earth in the laboratory. They would have been working on it like crazy. And then after the crash recoveries happened and they had crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft to examine and learn from, perhaps even living, you know, occupants, survivors of these crashes or landings, they would have put even more money towards reverse engineering this technology. So there's no doubt in my mind they would have been working on this from a very early time. But to answer your question, to go back, you know, my second big fear is, how does Marco Rubio and others get this information out of the private corporations? And all I can say is they are going to have to play hardball. They will have to get nasty. I hope I'm wrong. Maybe the private corporations will completely open up. Maybe it's a new generation. Maybe it's more open-minded people. I pray to God it is. I really do. But well, I'm skeptical of that.
I think the concern for laying everything out on the table, at least from a defense intelligence bureaucracy perspective, is that we have foreign adversaries that we don't want to give this information to. You know, I mean, Lou Elizondo has said similar things, you know, kind of explaining how it's not that we're trying to hide things from the public, it's that we're trying to hide things from our enemies. And what do you think about that? Do you think that that's still a logical reason for not wanting to disclose this information? Or do you think that we've come to a point where even if that's true, we need this out?
Okay. In a minute, I'm going to give my first of the three statements because I think that will help answer your question.
By all means.
But to begin, I will just say that I don't think, from one point of view, it could be not giving out secrets to North Korea or Iran or China. But in reality, I think there's another perspective. I think this perspective is really held from the companies that are working on this in the way done acknowledged special access programs, or maybe not even in special access programs. You know, these special access programs that have this technology, they could transfer it over to other programs that are completely private. They have no connection whatsoever to the Department of Defense or the Department of Energy. And I think from their perspective is a little different in that they realize this wouldn't just give an advantage to any one company around the world or a competitor or an advantage to a specific hostile nation, it would be a global equalizer. Basically, it would give godlike technology to every single country around the world. A small, tiny country like Madagascar or, you know, Sri Lanka or, you know, some island country, they could start an anti-gravity program and build their own vehicle that could travel around the solar system. And they could do so on a reasonable budget. And they don't want that because Lockheed and these private corporations would instantly have hundreds of competitors. And you have to realize the entire system will change. The global economy will change fundamentally. The whole paradigm that we live in will shift when we realize that by manipulating the vacuum, we can basically achieve anything we want. We can control gravity. We can control inertia. We can manipulate the flow of time. We can produce unlimited clean energy. We can synthesize elements. Whatever, like you said earlier, eventually we will be able to produce specific rare isotopes. That's one thing Sapphire is interested in, is producing rare isotopes that could be very valuable. And we could, you know, for metal production, you know, instead of just synthesizing new metal in a laboratory, it would be very simple to just send a ship out to the asteroid belt and haul back a small asteroid to Earth orbit or lunar orbit. And, you know, some of these asteroids are worth trillions of dollars, even the small ones, because they have pure ores of precious metals. You could get, you know, millions of pounds of palladium, for example, from some of these asteroids. And it would just change everything fundamentally and alter our view of the universe. You know, no longer would we just be just a human species on our planet. We would realize, okay, we're here on the planet, but there's other extraterrestrials visiting us on this planet. They have bases on this planet. There's a million other civilizations in our galaxy, plus there's energy beings on this planet. We live in a very complex ecosystem of sentient life. And we're going to realize that we have a spiritual essence, that we have an immortal soul, and these fleshly bodies are just containers for our soul, and that there's really no such thing as death. It's just, you know, an exiting of our body. It's the taking off of a garment and going to another stage of life.
One of my intelligence buddies said that death is just you expanding beyond the focalized, crystallized point into the expanded wave function.
I could agree with basically what he said there. Do you have anything else to say before I read my first statement?
No, by all means, I'd love for you to give these statements.
Okay, and I just want to read this because I was just trying the other night to, no pun intended, coherently organize my thoughts on some of these matters. And I know I tend to ramble a little bit, so I try to focus sometimes and really try to be a little more concise. So I made these three statements, and I'm just going to start with the first one, and then please feel free to ask any questions you have. And I'm going to read this, and I'll tell you when I'm finished. Okay, number one, my first statement. The creation, structuring, and control of coherent matter and light is the fundamental physical mechanism that is the basis of a wide range of seemingly anomalous phenomena. The non-Newtonian performance characteristics of UFOs, the similar capabilities of man-made reverse-engineered vehicles, the exotic effects produced by cold fusion or LNR reactors, the broad range of psychic abilities that have been repeatedly documented, the consciously manifested spherical luminous structures alleged to be utilized by non-human beings or intelligences for transportation, and perhaps the nature of our immortal soul are connected inseparably to the concept of coherency. Simultaneously simple to the point of unmatched elegance, yet capable of being engineered in a multitude of ways, this mechanism is the key to engineering the vacuum and mastering physical reality. This represents the final key to all the kingdoms on our planet and across the universe for now and to eternity. I just wanted to basically get my opinion across in a concise manner. That's basically what I have came to believe after my years of researching. I've been interested in this field since I was a small child, and my interest has only grown. And in my teenage years, I continued to expand my research into alternative energy and other technologies. And basically, that is pretty much the sum of what I believe at this point.
Well, there was some other things that you wrote. To be honest, I think it all pretty much leads into each other. And unless you wanted to space it out, I think it's worth reading now.
I'll make my second statement, okay? A sudden, nonlinear, or high rate of change electrical discharge induces an intense field and hence magnetic vector potential between a pair of electrodes. Two competing effects will occur in regards to the particles between them. Their increase in momentum will reduce the length of their de Broglie wavelength, while the flow of magnetic vector potential will counter this shortening. If the magnitude of the vector potential is high enough, even if only transiently, a net lengthening may be sufficient to make the waveforms overlap, their phases synchronize, and induce them into a coherent state. Moreover, the magnetic vector potential and the self-generated magnetic field produced by these charged particles may induce self-organization in the shape of a torus or a ball, allowing nature to work further against entropy and produce an exotic vacuum object, EVO. The potentials and fields within this structure may allow for the maintenance of coherent matter or even provide the ideal conditions to increase the rate of production, not to be mistaken as only an organized construct of non-coherent ions and electrons, an ordinary plasma of the fourth phase of matter. The primary unique feature of an EVO are internal layers of matter in a state similar to a Bose-Einstein condensate, the fifth phase of matter. Instead of attempting to force the production of coherent matter with complex technological systems, establishing the conditions for an EVO to form and allowing it to do the work may be far more advantageous. By changing the parameters of the environment in which this structure exists, this almost lifelike organism can be guided and directed. By mastering the formation of EVOs and manipulating the fields they produce, the vacuum can be engineered in such a way to accomplish any goal. Energy becomes free and unlimited. Transportation is revolutionized, allowing for faster than light travel. Gravity, mass, and inertia can be modified. Everything becomes possible. Done. Let me take a sip of water while you speak.
Yeah, no, please. So, I mean, essentially what you're highlighting here is what we've been talking about throughout this entire conversation, which is the idea of this concept of EVOs, self-organizing plasmas, this technology being able to essentially bleed into the same applications that we're seeing through the UFO UAP phenomenon, and the capabilities that are being mimicked through the same technologies that we're observing in these UAPs, UFOs, and how we might eventually be able to get to this point if we can acknowledge that this is the fundamental way in which we should be, you know, moving our technology forward. At least there are most likely many facets of this type of technology, but what you're seeing through the Sapphire Project, what you're seeing through self-organizing plasmas, this EVO phenomenon, is a potential doorway into what these craft might be using.
Absolutely. I totally agree. You said it perfectly. I do believe that all of the different phenomena that we have witnessed in the UFO phenomenon, and then that combined with remote viewing, combined with spoon bending, combined with other psychic phenomenon, even healing, I believe it's all basically connected around coherent matter and controlling these coherent structures. If you look at what Chris Bledsoe has talked about with the orbs that he sees on a regular basis, he has witnessed, and how sometimes he believes and he claims that he has photographs of these orbs that seem to show this, especially when they are, adjusted, not changed, not altered, but just the contrast and, you know, the basic settings adjusted a little bit to make it more clear that it looks like there's beings inside of them. I believe it's very possible that this same concept is used by extraterrestrials and technological craft. I believe it's used by humans in reverse engineered craft. I believe it's used in systems like the Sapphire Project, which is, you know, in the white world. It's not in the black world. I believe it's used by these energy beings or whatever they are. We don't know exactly what they are, but they could manipulate these structures with their consciousness, with their mind. They may be able to manipulate and create these structures consciously and then travel within them. That's just something that seems to be possible. And I really think that this is the one phenomena, this coherent matter and the control of it, and especially the EVO, because the EVO seems, and remember, EVOs represent a broad category of structures that could be composed of matter, like atoms, positive ions, electrons, which are negatively charged. It could be photons. But so an EVO is a self-organizing structure of many different, that could be of many different types of matter. So it's a broad category. There's not just one type of EVO. The geometry can differ. The composition can differ. Their internal organization can differ. Their size can differ. Their energy can differ. So it's a broad category. But the key theme is that these EVOs self-organize. And when they do, they become nature's preferred method, the most efficient way nature has figured out to produce coherent matter and to utilize that coherent matter to manipulate the vacuum. This is number three, my third statement. The knowledge of coherent systems, including their ubiquitous nature and enormous potential, is the right of every sentient organism born, hatched, cloned, replicated, or constructed in this universe. All efforts to suppress this knowledge are nothing short of atrocities. There is no valid excuse to sequester or hide such fundamental information. For anyone to do so is an act of absolute arrogance. No one has the right to keep this to themselves, their corporation, the organization, or their country. Without this knowledge, we cannot understand the universe, the structure of physical reality, or ourselves. A civilization without this knowledge is beyond a farce, a disaster waiting to happen. The suppression of these truths only serve those whose greedy, selfish hearts cling to materialism. These parties seek to control the world in order to protect the status quo, in order to ensure the continuation of their power, profits, and way of life. Any disclosure will lead to a full revelation, so they put their own massive wealth before the survival and the future of our species. This must end. Anyone with an understanding of these truths or evidence of a greater reality must share what they know. Done. So that's my third statement. So I guess I just want to stress, you know, I wanted to share this information about EVOs, and this has just been a very brief overview. There's a wealth of additional information that's really, you know, difficult for me to convey without producing a formal presentation. I mean, if you ever wanted me to, I could make a formal PowerPoint presentation and we could go over it slide by slide by slide. But just talking, this is about the best I can do.
Well, I'll tell you what, everyone listening, drop a comment below if you want Mr. X to do a in-depth presentation on the EVO phenomenon so that we can get, quite an extensive overview of what this is about. Drop a comment below, and if we get enough people interested, maybe we can do that.
Yeah, maybe we can do that at some point. You know, I really just want to get the idea across that this technology is emerging. with the Sapphire Project. You know, and again, I want this another thing I didn't mention earlier. We know that Eric Davis, he proposed, and this is fact because there's a document online called the Ball Lightning Study. And that's a document that Eric W. Davis, who worked for Hal Puthoff, he produced for Edwards Air Force Base. And it was a review of the whole science and understanding of ball lightning. And as part of this, he discussed Kenneth Scholder's work. And he proposed a reproduction of a classic Kenneth Scholder's EVO generator. He had a bill of materials, a cost estimate, everything. And basically, through Stephen Greer and other sources, not just Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project, but others, it's basically been revealed that a visiting scientist went to Edwards Air Force Base, and that at some point he was shown the result, a classical Kenneth Scholder's EVO generator. And he was told that it works, it produces a very, very small amount of excess energy, but they don't know how to scale it up. But you know what? Sapphire is how to scale it up, because the classical Kenneth Scholder's EVO generator was generating a tiny little EVO that only existed for a very, very brief moment as it traveled across the gap and then slammed into the anode and destroyed itself. With Sapphire, you have a continual, stable, steady state macro EVO with what I personally believe to be a layer of coherent matter that's just continually producing energy, probably, in my opinion, both from novel nuclear reactions and transmutations, but also possibly extracting it from the vacuum itself. And so it is the way to scale up their effect. And I believe Hal Puthoff and Eric Davis know much, much, much more about coherent matter and EVOs and this whole subject area than they frequently talk about publicly. And I believe this is really the grand unifier, this knowledge of coherent matter and how to create it and how to stabilize it and then how to control it and guide it and direct it to accomplish any goal, any dream, anything that can come into your imagination. And I believe, again, the powers that be mastered this a long time ago because it's so simple. What Sapphire is doing is not overly complicated. What other parties right now, other companies are doing, which utilizes self-organizing plasmas, is not difficult. It's not overly complicated. I believe that the flux liner, although it had a multitude of different systems in it for different purposes, I believe the basic fundamental concepts involved in creating the plasma ball inside of it and directing the fields around the craft to create, in essence, a warp bubble was simple. But they don't want this information getting out. They don't want it revealed, because when it is revealed, it will change how we perceive reality. Because instead of living in a limited universe with limited possibilities where we've basically already figured out everything there is to know, and there's really nothing to look forward to except maybe a slightly faster computer, a slightly thinner cell phone, maybe a higher resolution computer screen. No, we live in a universe where we can extract unlimited energy from the vacuum. We can travel the stars. We can heal ourselves with electromagnetics. We can communicate at faster than light speeds. And we also, most importantly, live in a huge community full of sentient beings. And I believe that's why it's so important that people look into these exotic technologies, because although I'm looking for disclosure, and I think Rubio pushes hard at these private corporations, I hope he doesn't just, when he gets this report, I hope he does not just respond to the CIA or the NSA or the DIA. I hope he goes directly to these private corporations and say, we want what you have, because we're going to tell the world about this, because this cover-up has went on long enough. So that's what I hope happens. And I just urge everyone to do research into the Sapphire Project. Do research into self-organizing plasmas. Google topics like Eugene Podkletnov and his anti-gravity systems. You know, look up Kenneth Shoulders. Look up the book EV, A Tale of Discovery. Look up LENR and coal fusion, because EVOs are at the core of those systems as well. This is an amazing field, and this is only the beginning. And I believe that this secret is out. There's no putting it back in the bottle. And now the powers that be are basically just scrambling to try to slow down the process of it getting out. So any last questions or comments for me?
Well, I think that that's a perfect place to wrap it up. And you've summarized things really quite nicely there. And I certainly obviously want to thank you for coming back onto the channel. It's always a pleasure to have you on, Mr. X, because I always learn something new, and I'm pretty sure a lot of people listening can agree with that. We're in an extremely important time period right now. Much is changing, and I just honestly hope that we can see some of these amazing possibilities that we've discussed tonight become a reality. So I just want to say thank you once again for having this conversation with me.
And thank you so much for allowing me to speak with you. Thank you so much for everything you do on Project Unity. You do great work. You make great videos. You conduct fantastic interviews, and just keep up with your good work.